Welcome to Inova Radio, your place to gather insight and wisdom for creating healthy organizations. Discover how to uncover defects in your organization and find ways to be a powerful force of change for your organization. Here's your host, David Phillips.
Episode of Inova Radio. I'm your host, David Phillips. It's good to be with you. I hope you're doing well. It's the week of Valentine's as I'm recording this. And so I hope if you have a significant other in your life that you will take some time and do something very nice for them. I was grateful and thankful enough to be able to take my lovely wife to a murder mystery dinner theater the other night, where I got a chance to play, quote, the charming dude, and had a good time with that. And we had dinner, and there was a murder mystery we participated in. So I hope you have that opportunity and take advantage of it. It's something that I don't take for granted, and I hope you don't either. Today, I want to spend some time talking again about social change and corporate change and organizational change, such as, you know, the big picture concepts of change. And I want to go to a philosopher. A couple of years ago, I was doing some master's work in communication from the University of Wisconsin-Stout, which is Stout, Wisconsin. It's a technical college, more of a technical college, in Wisconsin, and had they had a master's in communication that you could take online. It was one of the few at the time, and so I took advantage of doing that. I have done some work in some PhD work in communication, and wanted to actually get a master's degree in it, and so I took a few classes, and I still have a couple of. If I think it's two more classes, then I'll have the hours to be able to teach communication in addition to my doctorate. And so took the opportunity to do that. And I was taking a class on rhetoric. And within that class, we read about a philosopher named Kenneth Burke. Burke was heavily influenced by Marx and Nietzsche and Sigmund Freud, oddly enough. And he was really focused on symbols and the power of rhetoric to move and create change by the use of symbols. So symbols was a huge idea for Burke. And But he defined rhetoric as the use of words by human agents to form attitudes or to induce actions in other human agents. And so the power of communication, the power of rhetoric, the power of symbol to bring about change within a social structure, whether it's an organization, a company, a country, a city, those kinds of things. And so Burke has been influential for many years. And so as I was reading about him, one of the things that kind of popped into my head in reading some of his stuff, one of the things that popped into my head was some of Burke's ideas function as a systems theory. And so that was actually the paper that I wrote that semester for this class was about rhetoric and systems theory, and I used Burke as to note those things. And it was first of all, it was an interesting paper. But it also helped me to re-engage some with systems theory. So one of the things that Burke's dramatistic model uses is it relates highly to systems theory. James McFarlane says that Burke feels the social or interpersonal dramas don't occur in a vacuum. Consequently, they must be studied in the context of their social setting as an organic event rather than a static event. The concern is not with observing any two segments, such as the relationship between act and scene, but the function of the act itself. Burke centers his attention on the interrelationships of the communication rather than any one aspect, such as speaker, message, or receiver. All of this is in the spirit of systems analysis. In other words, that the focus is on how the speaker and the receiver interact in the communication process, and that in essence is part of systems theory, is seeing how the two the two or more stakeholders, or the two or more members of the audience, interact with each other. Because communication is not one way. Communication is not simply it's not a two way, really. It's a multi way. So it's the speaker and the receiver and the background and the history of each of those. And so when we communicate, we have to take that into consideration. We have to know that the people that in whom we're trying to communicate to, or in whom we're communicating to. And we also have to take our own expression and our own understanding of ourself, that self-awareness, and be able to explain where we're coming from in a way that the people who we are communicating to can understand. So it's not just me communicating to you. It's me in my history, in my understanding of what's going on in the world and what's going on in the moment, my understanding of the concept in which I'm trying to communicate, and your understanding of who you are and your identity and what's going on in the world and what's going on in the moment and the message in which you're receiving and the environment in which the communication is taking place. So it's really a multifaceted aspect, and systems theory really speaks to that. So if you ever get a chance and want to spend some time in systems theory, you can hit me up on that too, because I'd love to talk about that. But so within Burke's people who have analyzed Burke's Burke's rhetoric and his philosophical framework attach system concepts to Burke's writings. And so Burke talks about ideology a lot. That's one of his big ideas, is the concept of ideology. And he sees the ideology in terms of identity, environment, core, and reality. And so an ideology is a culture. It's a set of values. It's a linguistic system or a set of social standards. It's more than that as well. It's a way of living, because it's the foundation of how humanity interprets reality, and also how humanity organizes socially. And so as language and consensus of thought develop, a social identity is formed dynamically by the use of rhetoric. And when that social identity is develop, community is created. And so ideologies form as a response to changes that take place within the environment, and ideologies need to be able to continuously adapt. And that's one of the things that Burke tries to push, and then also how an ideology changes. So in every emerging ideology, a governing ideological center is found, and that center is formed through a process of taking sub-ideologies, which means prioritizing sub ideologies, which means privileging some and marginalizing others. And so one, you know, couple of major messages begin to speak out and to be prominent and to be prioritized, and everything else is subdued and marginalized. And so you have, you know, just a couple of major messages. And so the center is a core of beliefs within the culture, and they would be formed out of those beliefs are formed out of rhetoric, out of the communication process. And so everybody's not going to agree with each other on every small item, but there are ways to have this dynamically formed ideological core. One is to come together on common ground. So, for instance, the Constitution of the United States was dynamically formed through rhetoric as the original states sought common ground. A second way to have an ideological core is to rally against a common enemy. So during World War II, the Soviet Union and the United States, you know, typically at odds with each other, both pursued a defeat of Germany under Hitler. And despite being distinct countries with two ideological systems and, you know, particularly two economic systems, the two countries were able to come together for a single purpose, which was the defeat of Adolf Hitler and fascism. And we actually saw that in the election in 2016. There were so many people who didn't want to vote for Trump, but the major message that he got out was to all of those who have been disenfranchised by the government, to all those who've been disenfranchised by globalist economic philosophical framework, by all of those who have been rejected by Washington, I'm here to speak to you, and I just tell it like it is. And so people began to rally around this message. There were a couple of ideas that really pushed Trump over the edge. One was an economic issue where voters in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and the Rust Belt and other parts of the country where jobs had been lost to globalization, they voted for him because he was the one that came and talked to them, and he was the one that heard them and wanted to bring jobs back to America, specifically to their areas. And so that was huge. And so that's why. And then a second prevailing concept that really pushed him forward, especially in southern states and more conservative states, was the concept of the Supreme Court. Who's going to be nominated to the Supreme Court, and what's the court going to look like over the next 3 or 4 years? And are some of these people going to retire or maybe pass on? And who's going to be nominating members to the Supreme Court? And so just a couple of concepts are the two that really brought people together for Trump. And so in a couple of ways, if you think about it, they came together on common ground. They also came together against a common enemy, which common ground was getting jobs back. Common enemy was the globalization and the economic framework of that. And the common ground was the Supreme Court, for instance. And so, as a result, Burke's ideological theory parallels chaotic systems theory. An ideology is a system. It's self-organized. It's, in this case, specifically through rhetoric, with an ideological core. And the core would be what systems theory would call the strange attractor. It's what everything centers around. And the system functions around that attractor, the ideology around its core. And it's through that system that reality is defined, just as ideology frames reality for those within it. And a healthy system never operates in exactly the same way over a period of time. The system will change and adapt based on the environments external to it and also the impact that adaptation has on the elements of the system internally. A healthy ideology does the same thing. It adapts, it morphs, it works with the environment and so how an ideology fully develops can't be predicted. Just like a system can't be predicted, the functions of a system can't be predicted. You never know what the impact will be of one person being changed on a team will make. For instance, back in the 90s, Fred McGriff was traded to the Atlanta Braves, and the Braves were, I don't know, 10, 15 games back. And McGriff came to the Braves in that trade. The Braves went out and got him. He came, and they went on a winning streak and ended up having the best record in the Major League Baseball that year. One person made a huge impact, and you really don't know how that impact is going to work itself out until you actually put it in there. It's a fascinating. Watch, but it can't be predicted. It may begin trending in one direction, then drastically change based on a sub-ideology that's elevated above all others, or the environment changes around it as it develops. And so elections are an example of that predictability, where the revelation of something scandalous can create a different outcome. Maybe some of you remember in 1988, Gary Hart was considered the front runner for the Democratic nomination for president. And then news organizations revealed he was having an affair. When that happened, he dropped out of the race completely. That's how quick and how drastic things can change. So let's talk about Burke's ideology theory, how it resembles a system, and how we can make an application here. So rhetoric is inherently relational. Let me say that again. Rhetoric is inherently relational. A system is an interrelated collection of several things, whether it's ideas or people or planets, and those elements are connected through a set of relationships that allow the individual pieces to operate as a whole, just like a team. And so rhetoric forms an ideology most effectively the same way that a system is formed, from the bottom up or through self-organization. And that happens best as persuasion works its way through the social networks of individuals. So as the persuasion and rhetoric work its way through, as the ideology and the ideas begin to penetrate as the social network, then they begin to form and self-organize. Small groups of people dynamically are formed through rhetoric, and connections between those small groups are made, or they're found in a large group consisting of multiple interrelated small groups begin to form. So the network gets bigger, it creates more possible connections between groups, and when that happens, dramatic shifts in thinking or a dramatic change in action can occur. The rhetoric occurring every day in a community can function like a gas-soaked wood waiting for the spark to create a blazing fire. And that's what happened, for instance, in 1989 in Romania. And I love this story. Poverty and debt created deplorable conditions for the people of Romania under the communist government. And then one event sparked a revolution that saw the fall of that government. Laszlo Tokes was a pastor in the Romanian Reformed Church, and he had become a thorn in the side of the government with his sermons complaining about the treatment of Romania's Hungarians as well as the bulldozing of villages to create collective farms. And so on December 15th, 1989, he was about to be evicted from his church and sent to a remote village because he'd given an interview denouncing the actions of the government to a foreign television crew that had smuggled into the country. And so when the authorities came to take him away, hundreds of his parishioners encircled his church. Then ethnic Romanians joined in. Others eventually joined him, and they broadened their picketing from focusing primarily on the country's leadership. As the news spread through social networks, people felt a sense of empowerment, and that led eventually to the overthrow of the government only a few days later. This is an example of a nonlinear, chaotic system. A small incident sparked a revolutionary change in Romania, and this is what rhetoric has an incredible power to do. It's to motivate people to action in a short period of time, and that action can be swift and transformative. And so, that's the power of rhetoric. That's the power of communication. Rhetoric operates within an ideology, just like compound interest works in a bank account. Rhetoric helps the ideology adapt, and that exerts the potential to change upon those living within that framework. Rhetoric helps change how symbols are used, and it also provides a way to reframe how we interpret reality. In fact, Burke went on to define humanity in terms of a symbol in his writing, Language as a Symbolic Action. He states that man is the symbol-making animal, inventor of the negative, separated from his natural condition by instruments of his own making, moved by the sense of order, and rotten with perfection. If rhetoric is how humanity uses symbols, and by definition humans make symbols, then humanity itself is an expression of rhetoric. The essence of rhetoric is found in everything a person does, including his unconscious thoughts or actions. That's the power of rhetoric. Now, something else Burke talked about is that if you're going to change, the danger with ideology is that it becomes calcified, that it stops interacting and reacting with the environment and the things going on within the system itself, and so it becomes calcified. The ideology can't change, and what happens is that there starts to be marginalization of a lot of different folks. And Burke, again, kind of going back to the idea that of language as symbolic action, that we are symbol-making people, then symbolic action is how we need to look at change. That in other words, we need to change the symbols. And when we change the symbols, we begin to change how people understand and view things. And in doing that, that begins to change the conversation. When you begin to change the conversation, you begin to start chipping away at the calcified ideology. And it changes reality. And so, but that all that happens from the bottom up. It's not necessarily a top-down organization. It's not a top-down, it's not something that happens in necessarily an organized fashion. It's something that happens at the bottom of society. It's something that happens when people begin to talk and have discussions and begin to be moved by the words and by the reality that they see. And so, so that's how Burt begins to talk about changing a system or changing an organization or changing a social structure. It happens from the bottom up. They get rigid. Those structures get rigid from the top down, so it has to change from the bottom up. The meaning of the symbols become self-perpetuating and calcified, struggling to change, so we have to reframe them. And that's how you begin to bring change to an organization. You begin to reframe the conversation based on what's going on and how you understand reality. What it does is it forces the top to address the conversation happening in the among the social interactions going on within the organization. And when enough people begin to buy into the communication and buy into the rhetoric and buy into the the new framework of thinking and the new reality and the new way of looking at life, then change begins to happen. And so we see that a lot in being attempted in our own country, in the United States, with Black Lives Matter and with the populist movement of Bernie Sanders and the populist movement of Donald Trump. And there are all of these people that are rising up and being moved to action. And they're challenging the existing frameworks, and they're challenging the existing symbols, and they're challenging the existing way of looking at reality. And when they do, when enough of them do come together and start communicating and talking about this, then people have to take notice and begin to address and begin to deal with that rhetoric. And some countries will deal with it by arresting leaders and putting them in jail and trying to squash that kind of communication, like Romania did and like South Africa did in some ways with Nelson Mandela, and like many communist governments do. Other countries will deal with it by having a conversation. And I think this is what's key. People can have a great message, but if they go at it and challenge the process in an improper manner, then their message gets drowned out because of the destruction that they may be causing. And we can say, well, you know, it's pent up frustration, and I get that. But there's also maturity as well. And if you want your message, like Martin Luther King, if you want the message to resonate, then you have to do it the right way. And that's what he did, and that's what happened in the 60s, and that's why the civil rights movement was so powerful back then. Now, there's much to be done still, but there was a great deal of change, and particularly the reason that it was so effective is because what was being shown on TV, a pacifist group doing it the right way and getting abused by the police. And a message of peace and a message of change, and it all just worked. So it wasn't a top-down issue, it was a bottom-up. Your message has to be good. There has to be people that can communicate effectively. There has to be a network of people in which things can spread and ideas can spread, and that rhetoric can spread. There has to be someone that's creative enough to help reframe the symbols that have come to exist and come to represent the ideology that is currently in place and that has calcified, there has to be, it's a lot of work. But it happens that way. That's the way it happens. Things happen from the bottom up. You know, the danger in all of that, though, is to, if you're going to initiate change and you're going to initiate that push, is that you have to do it the right way. You can't go slandering people, and you can't go yelling and cursing and all of that kind of stuff and want to fight and kill, and that's just ineffective. Because your message gets lost in the methodology. And the end doesn't justify the means, really. And so when you can create instability in the existing system and start chipping away at the ideology that has been calcified, then what begins to happen is the system begins to wobble, it begins to weaken, and it begins to change. It begins to change around a different set of values and a different set of thoughts and a different set of symbols. And the ideology that had been calcified begins to crumble. And so those who were determined not to let that ideology, that calcified ideology, change are now, unfortunately, on the outside looking in. So if we want to bring social change, if we want to move our nation in one direction, if you want to move your organization in another direction, if you want to move your family, move your church, it has to start from the bottom up. It has to be something that spreads and that communicates, gets communicated, and ideas need to be shared, and things can happen. And so that's how it happens in a system. That's how you bring change to a social structure. It takes work. It's not easy. But it can happen. Okay, and so I know that was probably overly technical and maybe a little deep, but I hope you got an idea of how we can change organizations and we can change social structures through through communication and through rhetoric and through changing symbols and those kinds of things. On our next episode, I've got a friend who runs an insurance company and a national insurance company that deals in health and dental and has a great foundation that she works with as well. And so she's going to be on the podcast. We'll be interviewing her. So her name is Sherry Paulus. So I hope you come back for that. And thanks for listening today. I hope you have a great weekend and a great week. And take care.
Thanks for listening in today, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Powerful Insight. For more up-to-date information and tips to help you on your quest for change, head over to the website at www.wdavidphillips.com and sign up for our newsletter.